Vision Radio Show with your host, Lonnie Clark. We stand together and accept that we now live in a world transformed by Fukushima. Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 8 a.m. to 9 a.m. Pacific Standard Time here on UCY.TV Radio. We relentlessly engage every ear that listens. We expose and confront the complete lack of accountability for the nuclear industry. Consider social engineering programs who view our bodies, minds, and souls as assets on a balance sheet. We discuss vital current issues, interview activists, and engage our audience in an effort to allow all voices to be heard. The Age of Vision Radio Show creates a venue that all will choose. We encourage our listeners to reclaim their power and their courage to take action and save our planet from the ravages of greed and indifference. Our actions matter. Every voice matters. We remind our listeners that happiness is resistance. Love is greater than fear.
Good morning, UCY.TV radio listeners. This is Lonnie Clark with the Age of Vision radio show. Thank you for joining us, and I am delighted to bring you a pre-recorded interview that I did with Dr. Chris Busby, a British scientist known for his theories about the negative health effects of very low ionizing radiation, which indeed we do discuss in the upcoming interview. I do want to advise you the first 30 seconds of this radio interview was cut off. I had just asked Dr. Busby, please introduce himself to our listeners. How did he become a nuclear expert? And as you will see, where he's just getting into the rest of that answer. Thank you for joining us. I hope you enjoy this interview as much as I did.
And then I decided I had enough of that, and I went off and did various sort of adventures on boats and sailed about the place and had children and, you know, did various things. And then I got interested in radiation and health. And this was really quite late on. This was around about 1988, 89, something like that, after Chernobyl. And then I got sucked into trying to discover or figure out how it was that radiation caused cancer and how it caused other kinds of diseases and what it did at the cellular level and all the rest of it. And I've been doing that now for about ever since then. I've published now over 40 scientific papers in the peer review literature and countless other papers that are not peer reviewed. And I've traveled all over the world measuring radiation in various levels, from Iraq to Kosovo to America. I've been involved in a lot of court cases as an expert, both as an expert witness and as a representative, many of which, or most of which, have been won, in fact. And to bring you right up to date now, what I am now is a kind of international expert on the health effects of radiation. And this has come about as a result of all the research that I've done. It's an awful lot of thinking, awful lot of studying, awful lot of examination of data, huge amount of work. In fact, I wish I hadn't sort of got involved in it to the extent that I did. But, you know, once you walk into that swamp, you kind of sink and you can't pull yourself out.
Right. Well, look, you know, my knowledge actually of all of this nuclear stuff is really new. On my YouTube channel, I read two books by Dr. John Goffman.
Yes, I read those. I knew Goffman.
You did? I mean, I was actually stunned. I read Poison Power, and I read a book that I thought was a joke. I bought it on Amazon. This was an interesting story, for $9, and I read it. It's called Population Control Through Nuclear Pollution.
Right, I haven't read that one.
It was kind of an esoteric little book. Once I started reading it on YouTube, the price went up to $999.01.
They must have only had a few copies around by then, I guess.
Yeah, so I don't know. It's kind of a weird thing. This gets back to what I really believe about this whole nuclear thing, is that I think we've been socially engineered to just pretend like there's no problem with nuclear. That is our hardest thing. Like, I'm stalked on Twitter by the NEI, basically, who tells me that anti-nukers are going to be considered climate deniers, that nuclear is the best thing that's ever happened to the planet.
Well, I think I've taken those people down. I mean, I think in another 5 years' time, you'll find that the work that my colleagues and I have done in this area of the science will make it quite clear that we know what's going on, and the people who are running the show now are wrong. I mean, this will happen. It'll take a while, because the momentum of the nuclear military lobby is absolutely immense. I mean, and the amount of money involved is gigantic. Uranium shares and nuclear powered vessels and navies and the use of depleted uranium and nuclear energy and all of that stuff. The amount of money and sheer power associated with that is enormous. So they are able, to some extent and for some time, to deny what is clearly there in the evidence. And of course, if you're a scientist, that's what you do. You know, you say, here is the evidence. Have a look at it. What do you think? Instead of that, what they do now is they don't look at the evidence, but they attack the person who's presenting the evidence. You see, so they say, well, hey, we know that this radiation stuff is safe because Dr. Bloggin says it's safe, you know, and he's the head of the International Association of Clever Guys. Or Professor Tweedledum, you know, from the University of Cambridge, says that it's okay. And we know that it must be right because he's Professor Tweedledum from the University of Cambridge. And nobody actually looks at the data, you see. This is the point. But eventually they'll have to. Eventually, throughout history, it has been data that has driven truth. And that's what science is. It's just another word for truth, okay? The problem at the moment is that truth has been constructed on the internet by a load of bloggers and mad people and people who are actually employed by the nuclear industry. I mean, it's an operation to shoot down people like me and to shoot down the truth and to, you know, ignore it and all the rest of that stuff. It's an operation.
Well, this is the thing that I find the most confounding. It's been 70 years. I interview Thaston Rickman from the Marshall Islands. His whole culture was decimated. Their people do not even talk about it. He said it's worse than airing your dirty laundry. The blanket of silence from the people, but what astounds me is the scientists deny the harm that it causes to the human species and to other species. There's people up in Hanford up here. I live in Oregon, Eugene, Oregon, and there's people, you walk into Richland and they do not talk about their dad dying of cancer, their kids having microencephaly. I'm in school and a girl, she had this big thing down her chest. She's like, oh yeah, I was born with a hole in my heart. I'm like, oh my God, where were you born? She's like, oh, we lived in Richland. My dad worked at Hanford. And I'm like, that is a genetic defect of exposure to radiation. She's like, well, how come our doctor didn't tell us that?
We can see exactly how this is working now when we see what happens after Fukushima in northern Japan.
Right.
Yeah? My colleague Alexei Yablokov pointed out long ago that the control of the information that came out after Chernobyl was almost total. So doctors were told by the Soviet Union that they weren't allowed to diagnose leukemia, you see. And so, of course, then the data that comes out is skewed. In the case of Japan, no data comes out. But if by some accident, some fluke of fortune, some data emerges, like the thyroid cancer issue, and we have now absolutely incontrovertible evidence that there's an enormous increase in thyroid cancer in 0 to 18-year-olds in Fukushima, you know, because they've measured it with ultrasound and so forth. Now we have complete ignoramuses like that woman, Professor Geraldine Thomas, you know, being trotted out being poked out on the end of a stick to say that it was all there anyway, and it was there beforehand. And meanwhile, of course, you know, the Japanese government threatened the doctors that if anybody actually comes out and says anything about this, they will just go to jail. I mean, we know this from all the people who tell us this. You know, so it's a kind of Sovietization of the world in the area of radiation and health. That's what's happened.
It's the militarization. I mean, that's really the issue, is this is about the war machine. It's war profiteering.
Well, of course, that's true. And I mean, and it's not a minor point either, because I mean, Alexei Yablokov told me long ago in 96 when I met him in Oxford that if you consider that the world is a chessboard and you look at all of the squares on the chessboard, 64 squares, and you consider all of the value that there is in the world in terms of money, if you like to see it all in terms of money, which you can do. It said that where we operate, where ordinary people operate, is one square on the bottom left-hand side of the chessboard, and everything else is military spending.
Right.
Okay? Well, I mean, given that that level of power exists in the West, and well, not just in the West either, it's not difficult to see how it is that that these people can cover up the truth, that they can airbrush the truth. And we know how the Soviets airbrushed the truth during the Soviet era. And those of us that can see the evidence can see quite clearly how the media airbrushed the truth, you know, in our own era now. Of course, you know, we have these independent people like yourself and Libby Halevi and a few other people, and we can poke our stuff in all over the place. And I can get stuff out on Russia Today because I'm a correspondent for Russia Today. So we can sort of chip away at the system. But the most important thing that I can do and what I am doing is to get stuff into the peer review literature. There's a scientific peer review literature still a place where you can get stuff in that eventually they have to deal with.
That is true. You know what? Because I'm a student, I have access to the libraries of peer-reviewed studies. So I go on, and I've actually found some. Like, I found a study done in 2013 by a group of scientists in Spain that said basically the safety culture model, which is used at all the nuclear facilities of the IAEA, had never been tested, ever. It had never been empirically tested.
No, and that's right. Well, in fact, if it ever is tested... Well, I mean, it's hard to see how it could be empirically tested. I mean, that's one point. I mean,
they came up with an idea. They actually studied. They had three groups. They had some students. I actually read that. To be honest, I don't really speak science. what I mean? But I read the scientific article on my YouTube channel because I wanted it to get out there. I want people who do speak science really understood it. But basically, what they did was they took three different types of groups of people to test. And the safety culture model is really about your comfort level with reporting problems, with identifying issues. There's a category of eight categories that they have in this testing. And there was a nuclear power plant in Spain that agreed to test it, actually test it on site. And in their testing, it only one area passed by about 50%, all the other areas failed, which is why we probably have such catastrophic problems with every nuclear facility is.
That must be a different kind of safety model to the one I'm thinking of. The one I'm thinking of is the one that I attack, which is the one that says so much radiation causes so much cancer. That's the model. That's the important model. That's the one that was developed after the Hiroshima bombing. And the study of the survivors of the Hiroshima bombing. So on the basis of that, they said, well, this amount of dose causes this amount of cancer.
Wasn't that Dr. John Goffman did that? Was that the same work?
He did that, but I think he got it wrong, actually. I mean, I had big arguments with Goffman about all of this. Goffman never distinguished between external and internal dose. He came in on the scene after Sternglass. What happened was that Sternglass turned up and he said, hey, look, you know, all these kids are going to die of leukemia and infant deaths and so on as a result of exposure to radiation. And he managed to get this into some magazine. I think Esquire it was. This was in the 60s. And it got to Kennedy. And Kennedy then, you know, signed the agreement with Khrushchev to stop the nuclear testing. Because Sternglass's point, which he developed as a result of quite a few... I knew Ernest Sternglass. He was a mate of mine. He used to come over all the time to England, you know, because he has a daughter here. We used to meet up and we gave talks in the House of Commons and so forth. And he told me this story. So anyway, he managed to get this evidence to Kennedy, and then Kennedy closed down the atmospheric nuclear testing. Right. Now, the point is that then the Atomic Energy Commission in America got really upset about this, and they had a go at Sternglass, and they asked Goffman, who was working for them then, to check over Sternglass's calculations, you see. So anyway, Goffman said, all right. So he went and checked over Sternglass's calculations, and he said, oh, well, he's wrong, but he's only slightly wrong. So, but actually, you know, a lot of what he says is true. And so instead of being this number of dead people, it's that number of dead people, you see. And that's how he got into it. And at that point, of course, they got upset with Goffman and kicked him out.
So, yeah, in that book that I read, A Population Control Through Nuclear Pollution, on my YouTube channel, he explained how him and Tamplin were hired by the government to determine what safe level of radioactivity there is, right? So yeah. He said they wanted to study 100,000 people. The government said no. Then they said, okay, give us 1,000 people. The government said no. Then he said, okay, how about 100 people? The government said no. They actually were allowed to study 10 people. And in 10 people, they found no effects of radioactivity. So they basically said to him, well, since there's nobody in 10, we know for sure, at least we can't say 1 in 100 would be affected. We can't really say 1 in 1,000. But we for sure know that 1 in 10,000 would be affected. That's how they came up with the 1 in 10,000 scenario that they're using.
I don't think so. I think that they came up with that, if I may say so, by looking, or at least maybe originally when they were talking to Goffman, that was the case. But more recently, the people who are in charge of the 1 in 10,000 idea are an outfit called the International Commission on Radiological Protection, which is a sort of offshoot of the American National Council for Radiological Protection, the NCRP, which was set up in the 50s. And their analysis of the health risks from radiation go back to the Hiroshima study. So all this whole thing, this whole area, is based on the study of the survivors of the Hiroshima bomb. It's what's called the lifespan study. It was originally run by an American-Japanese outfit called the Atomic Bomb Casualty Commission, and then in 1975 or thereabouts, it got converted to another, also American-Japanese outfit called the Radiation Effects Research Foundation, and they're still around. So these people are still studying, because of course a lot of these people are still alive, they're still studying the numbers of cancers in various other health effects, although not many, in the people who were exposed at Hiroshima to the bomb. But the problem is, and Goffman swallowed this stuff, and this is why I disagree with Goffman, because what they do is they take the dose that these people got by standing out there when the bomb went off, and of course a lot of them were just atomized and vaporized, so we're not talking about those people. Right. We're talking about people who were far enough away to get a radiation dose but not to be vaporized, yeah? Now these people were accumulated into various groups, you know, aggregated into various groups of dose by distance away from the bomb. And so what they do is they look at these people with regard to the amount of cancer they had, and they did tests in the Nevada desert, and they put dummies there and measured the amount of radiation at different distances from the similar bomb which they dropped in the Nevada desert as a test. So they know roughly what the dose was, but this was an external dose. It was just gamma radiation and neutrons, that's all, okay? And so they worked the dose out in terms of gamma radiation and neutrons. And they originally were going to compare these people in terms of their dose, so big dose, little dose, very small dose, and then no dose. And their no dose group were people who were from Hiroshima but had been out of the city doing whatever when the bomb went off, and then they came in afterwards. Okay, so this is their zero dose group. Right. So in 1973, they started to discover... Well, anyway, the point is that the cancer risk model, the 1 in 10,000 thing that you're talking about, is based on the chances of developing cancer per whatever it is dose.
For external use.
So that's how it works. So in other words, in the regulation all over the world now, certainly in America, but in Europe too, is that you're not allowed to get more than a dose of 1 millisievert. A millisievert is about half the total dose from natural background radiation. And on the basis of that, on the basis of the Hiroshima study, what they say is that that will give you a probability of one cancer in 10,000 people. It's 1 in 10,000, not 1 in 100. Or is it 1 in 100,000? No, it's 1 in 100,000. Yeah. Okay. So that's your probability. 1 in 100,000 if you get 1 millisievert. So that's the cutoff level, and that's based on the Hiroshima stuff. But the point is that the Hiroshima, and what I've discovered in the last, well, not long ago, in the last year or two, is that the Hiroshima study was dishonestly fitted up. It was actually, and Goffman didn't know this. He took it as kosher. Goffman believed all of these numbers, you see.
It's true. It's,
and he did his calculations on the basis of the numbers, and he found that they were out by a factor of 20. So that's what Goffman did. But he only concerned himself with this external radiation, the gamma radiation from the immediate bang. That's it. Woof. Everybody gets some gamma radiation, different levels of radiation. But, of course, the people who weren't there didn't get anything at all, according to the model. Now, in 1973, what we discovered is that these people started to show that there was much higher level of cancer in the exposure group because they seemed to be too healthy, you see, because they were a control group. So what happened then is that the epidemiologists threw them out. They said, well, if we keep these people in as a zero-dose control group, it's going to show much too much cancer, right? 100 times too many. So we're going to throw them out because we're going to say that, oh, they're too healthy. We can't have them as a control group. So that's it. Out they go. And I actually discovered this. It's all written down. It's in their internal reports, but you've got to really dig to find it, you see. So there we are. That's the problem. So Goffman didn't know that. But when you look at the actual data and you find that they threw this out, what it means is that the basis for all of these risk models that basically regulate all of nuclear throughout the United States and throughout the world is completely bogus.
Completely. I'm reading right now, I buy up these used old books. I'm reading this book called Radiation Studies, Remembering the Early Years. It's an oral history that the United States Department of Energy conducted in 1994 because they discovered that all of the documents about radiological studies was just discarded and in closets, and that there is no documentation at all as to who gave the orders on the human radiation studies. There's no documentation. There's many instances where there's absolutely no line of, there's no chain of command. They can't figure out who gave the orders and what was said. Nothing was documented. So the government decided to conduct oral histories.
Sure. Well, they've thrown it all away, haven't they? I mean, we found that in the nuclear test veterans case, that we find hardly any evidence at all. I mean, they said, oh, it's all disappeared. Oh, it was never produced.
Right.
Oh, we never... all this kind of stuff. You know, they cover their backs.
Don't you think, I mean, honestly, you've gone into court with these people, but where is their humanity? Like, what is their sense? Like, they're just destroying people's lives, like, at such an, and our environment. These are long-term effects that are not going to go away quickly.
Well, all these questions were asked by Hitler, weren't they?
Yes.
The point is, if you're talking about, you know, the psychology, why do people do what they do in those sorts of situations? The fact is there are lots and lots of psychological experiments that show that people would rather stay in the group than to stand up for what they know to be right. There's all those Margam experiments about the people who are being electrocuted. You know, you get these guys in a bogus experiment where they give electric shocks to people and they give them more and more and more electric shocks. And the people are, you know, of course, they're students. They're just pretending to have electric shocks. So no real electric shocks. They're actors, okay? Mm-hmm. The real people who are being studied here are the ones who are giving the electric shocks, okay?
Oh, to see if they do it on command.
Yeah. And so long as the man in the white coat behind them who's supervising says, no, give him a high electric shock, they do. They don't say stop. They don't say I'm not going to give him electric shocks, obviously, you know, causing him a lot of anguish and harm, and it's wrong. They don't. They continue to do it. And so we know that there's a sort of very powerful human need to belong. And so that these people belong to a group of people, which I don't know what you might call them, nuclear scientists, you see. And they'd rather belong to that group than to say, well, hang on a minute, there's a lot of evidence here that what we're doing is wrong and that we're killing people. And after a while, they realize that, I mean, certainly by the time they get to the age 50, let's say, or 55, when they're in control, when they, you know, in higher levels of control in these organizations, to admit that they're wrong at that point would be to admit that they have already killed an awful lot of people, do you see? they're going to have to deny their life, their life's work, and people will not do that. I mean, lots and lots of psychological studies, sociological studies have shown that people will not suddenly change around and deny what it is they've done. Very few people do that. That's a sort of like a Pauline conversion, but it's quite rare.
Kind of like all those the guards that were guarding Nuremberg, they sort of went into hiding. If they weren't arrested, they went into hiding and pretended it never really happened. They never, ever owned up to it. You know what I mean? There was a huge... I actually said that one time, that the World War II never ended. They just infiltrated the United States.
Well, I think there's certainly some truth in that. I don't know if they infiltrated, but an awful lot of them came to the United States. All other countries, and they're still around, you know. They're still around. Yeah, well, I mean, you know, really, the real question one has to ask, I mean, what I ask anyway, is why do people do these things? You know, why is there a culture of doing that? You know, why do we have people who form a group where they do those sorts of things? What's the energy in human beings that make them act like this? And of course, it goes right back through history. You know, you can go right back to as far as history goes back to see people behaving like this. And thing is, what's going on? Anyway, I mean, that's a more interesting question. The question of, I mean, I talk to these people in committees, and I oppose them in courts of justice. And they do, when you actually pin them to the wall, and it's not difficult to do that, their eyes sort of dart about sort of madly, you know, and they tend to sort of just spout nonsense or make animal noises. This happened, you know. No, truly. I mean, if you can. I mean, I've been right up there, very, very high levels, dealing with these people, and when you get them to the point where they cannot respond, there is no answer, you know, and they know that they've been nailed, then they just make animal noises.
Reverting back to their animal nature.
But of course, it doesn't help, you know. It really doesn't help. It doesn't help, because then they go away and they rationalize what it is that's happened and write whatever it is they were going to write anyway. But I think probably if we're going to win this, we need to laugh at them.
That's what I think. And I think we need to walk in love. I think we need to just like completely be committed to us, knowing that it's what we're doing, the right thing. That's my thing. It's like, this is the thing about the Fukushima thing. Do you think that Fukushima threw us off Niagara Falls in a barrel? Like, do you think we've like gone so far that it's just so catastrophic because they can't stop it? I mean, I heard Michio Kaku on Democracy Now! Last week say that Fukushima has only emitted 10% of the radiation that Chernobyl did.
Well, no, that's not right. It's about the same.
I don't know how it could even be 10%, because aren't there three nuclear meltdowns that are still ongoing in Fukushima? Those meltdowns haven't ended, have they? They're not completely
done.
No,
they haven't ended, but the amount that's coming out now is very small compared to the rate at which it's coming out now is not very high compared to the enormous amount that came out right at the beginning. So yes, the answer is it is still contaminating the Pacific, and yes, they probably can't stop it doing that, and yes, it probably will go on forever. But you know, at the same time, the amount that's coming out, taken as a total quantity into the size of the Pacific Ocean, is not catastrophic as far as the survival of the world is concerned. A lot of people say it is, you know. So like,
right,
you have,
I've heard that much.
So I mean, so this is a position, you know, and they're always positions. Everyone's got a position, okay? Mm-hmm. But my position is based on numbers. It's based on empirical evidence and numbers and counting and measurement and all that stuff. Well, I may be wrong, but that's what I do. So I look at the numbers. And the first thing you can say about it, well, I mean, first of all, compared to Chernobyl, it is about the same. So if you look at the total numbers,
it be the same though if it was a full three nuclear meltdowns and one third core meltdown? How could that be the same?
It's because not all of it came out. That's why. Whereas with Chernobyl, a lot more of it came out. So Chernobyl was a much bigger explosion, and it sort of mostly vaporized what was there. Although, you know, and it was all measured all over the place. So we roughly know what happened and how much came out, roughly. And on the basis of what we roughly think came out, we have a number, so many becquerels, okay, 10 to the 17 or something like that. So then if you look at the amount that were measured, because people have measured this stuff, they've been a lot of course, TEPCO we don't believe, but a lot of reasonably reputable analytical systems have been applied to the releases from Fukushima, and we've got measurements that I kind of believed, in the Pacific water, in the fish, on the ground. I mean, I followed it right from the very beginning, because I was the first person to say this was like a major nuclear explosion and not some kind of pathetic. I was on the BBC like on the day that it happened saying this. And they were all saying, oh, well, it's not even as bad as Three Mile Island. But anybody who looked at the pictures could see that it was worse.
Right, it blew up, the plant blew up.
Explosion and everything flew up in the air, you know.
Well, that's what makes me, as a layperson, think it had to have exploded more nuclear radiation, because it actually blew up, whereas Chernobyl...
No, you didn't see a picture. I mean, there were no cameras focused on Chernobyl when it blew up. I mean, that was something else. You see the... Chernobyl afterwards. I mean, it's like there's nothing there, you know.
Right.
It's just like a hollow with sort of black smoking bits underneath it. No, it was roughly the same. Okay, different radionuclides, roughly the same total of quantity of material. Fortunately, a good deal of it went out to sea. Otherwise, it would have been really bad, because the point is, around Chernobyl, you haven't got such a large population as you have in northern Japan. And what we're interested in here is the exposure to the population, okay? So Chernobyl was bad because it was in a part of Europe where it could spread over areas that were populated. Fukushima, a lot of it went out to sea. A lot of it fell on the USS Ronald Reagan, which is something that I'm involved in the court case there. But by the time it got onto the land, it had gone out to sea and come back again. There was the wind changed, and it went round in a circle, and it came back up through Tokyo, and then some of it went north to Iwate and all that stuff. Right. So in terms of the total amount, if we say it's the same as Chernobyl, and forget about the stuff that's coming out now, which was very bad, I agree, blah, blah, and all the rest of it, but it's really quite marginally small compared to the amount that came out right at the beginning. Fractional. That amount represents less, or significantly less, than the total amount of radiation that was released into the atmosphere at the time of the weapons testing in the Marianas, the bikini testing, okay?
Yes.
The American testing in the South Pacific. That was massive.
Right.
I mean, that was absolutely massive. They've got like huge, like 44 megatons of explosions, with all fission products going all over the place, getting up as far as Japan. In fact, they had to... They contaminated that fishing vessel, the Lucky Dragon, and then by the time all those vessels were coming into Tokyo or into southern Japan with their fish cargo, the fishing fleet, they could measure the radioactivity in the fish, even with primitive Geiger counters. Nowadays, we have really sophisticated things that can measure tiny amounts, but the fish were just crackling. So, and that hasn't killed everybody, okay? It's caused an awful lot of horrible stuff in the area itself, in the Marianas areas, in the Marshall Islands. And I was in the Human Rights Council in Geneva talking to the people from the Marshall Islands, and I presented a paper there about the effects. But even so, they're still around, The Marshall Islanders are not all dead.
But they all have diabetes. I mean, this is the thing. You don't die right away from radiological exposure. You get various illnesses that impede your quality of life.
Of course. I mean, there'll be, and we know, and also that is happening. I mean, if you're talking about the end of life on Earth and all that, I mean, we know that the releases of radioactivity to the environment from the weapons fallout in the 60s is the cause of the current and increasing cancer epidemic. Okay, I mean, in 1995, in 1965, the cancer, your chance of getting cancer in your lifetime is about 1 in 10. By 1995, it was about one in seven. Then by 2008, it was about 1 in 5. Currently, it's about 1 in 3. And the World Health Organization, not me, say that by 2020, it's going to be 1 in 2. So imagine every person is going to have one person that gets cancer in their lifetime, okay? So, I mean, but nobody says, why is this? But anyway, the answer to why is this is because they've been releasing more and more radioactivity.
Right.
And the biggest release has been the weapons fallout.
Dr. Busby, let me ask you this, because I interviewed Chuck Johnson from Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility, and I asked him about this, and he doesn't think it affects it, but because you know, the whole global warming, the climate change thing, there's the National Resource Defense Fund here in the United States who worked with the state of Illinois to keep two crippled nuclear power plants. They're leaking. And they basically told me they want to close down coal. They think leaking nuclear power plants are safer than the continuance of coal. I contend that all of this nuclear pollution is probably contributing to the global warming. It's kind of just an intuitive sense about it. You can't add all of this radioactivity that causes, it's hot particles. I don't know if it's like actually hot. But, I mean, I can't see that all the elements like going into the ocean on a nonstop basis now for 6 years has not affected the microscopic animals in the ocean at a level to where it's helping to warm up the ocean. Like, I think that with all this 60, 70 years of nuclear pollution, that it has actually contributed to the global warming. It goes hand in hand. It's not separate. Like I said, I don't speak science, so this is just like an intuitive gut level head.
Well, the answer is no. The amount of heat associated with radioactive disintegration is microscopic, so it's not a big deal. The reason that radiation is very dangerous is because it attacks DNA. And that's nothing to do with its temperature. That's just to do with the fact that it causes ionization in the DNA, and the DNA then...
Well, I was thinking more like it's got a catastrophic effect on the microscopic organisms
that keep the health of the ocean.
And without those microscopic organisms in the ocean... The ocean's going to get warmer because it's not functioning the way it's supposed to.
I see. Okay. Well, I mean, that's a good point. No, I haven't thought about it. That's possible. I mean, what you're saying is if it kills the microplankton, then they're not going to photosynthesize, and then they're not going to trap CO2. Yeah, no, that's a very interesting point, which I hadn't thought about. Well, that is entirely possible. Yes, of course. That is possible. Yeah,
so, that's something that's not even been looked at by anybody.
Not as far as I know. And I mean, well, of course, because they think, you know, I mean, the current argument is that it has no significant effect on these animals. But of course, they're wrong. I mean, there's a chap called Awad Hashjar. I mean, I don't know about the microplankton, but I certainly know about invertebrate life. I mean, the worms and the mussels have been studied by this bloke in the University of Plymouth, who's looked at levels of tritium in Plymouth because they have a nuclear submarine base in Plymouth and they release a lot of tritium. And he's measured the amount of tritium and he's looked at the effects on these animals and shown that even at tiny, tiny levels of tritium, it causes a breakdown in their development. So in other words, they not so many of them develop. So you get fewer of these animals. Well, if you get fewer of those animals, they are in the food chain. They're the bottom end of the food chain for everything that goes up from there.
Right.
And so that will have, and the amount of tritium that they produce from these nuclear reactors, you know, like, well, ones near the sea, but all of them really, and also from nuclear reactors on vessels. And also as a result of nuclear testing and all of that stuff, tritium, enormous amounts of tritium are released. Now the argument is that tritium confers a very low dose because it's a very weak beta emitter, but it certainly had an effect on the lower forms of life in the sea. And so I wouldn't have thought it was impossible that it would have effect on CO2 trapping in the way that you suggest. That's possible. But of course, the other thing to say is that if you take the nuclear fuel cycle from cradle to grave, you know, from mining all the way through to disposal, the amount of CO2 generated in that is quite a lot.
Well, yeah, actually, we don't dispose of it. I mean, not when we think about it. There is no disposal. We store the waste. They're not disposing of it. It's not like, oh, they make it go away. They're storing it. And that actually, the energy involved in maintaining it, I mean, billions of dollars. It has robbed the planet of our ability
You have to burn a lot of fuel, you know, diesel, to keep it cool. You have, you know, to drive it here to there, to drill big repositories in the ground and stick it down there and all this stuff. I mean, that's not energy that's produced by nuclear. That's energy that's produced by burning diesel. So the International Energy Agency in Paris did a study some time ago, in 2005 thereabouts, I don't know, but anyway, long time ago, which calculated the amount of CO2 that would be saved, and they came to the conclusion that it wouldn't be any, because in fact the amount of CO2 involved in using fossil fuel in order to run the whole fuel cycle, right the way from mining through to disposal, would be, you know, considerable.
Right. Let me ask you this, since you bring up tritium, because, you know, here in the States there's this report that New York City Indian Point nuclear power plant is leaking tritium into the Hudson Bay 65,000% higher than is allowable by the Nuclear Regulatory Agency. Does that present, like you'd mentioned that it's a low level, does that present any type of a particular health effect on any of those people in New York drinking from that drinking water? Because the Hudson Bay provides drinking water to New York City.
Well, if it's in the drinking water, then it creates a hazard. And anyone living on the coast where there are significant levels of tritium in the water is going to be affected by the vapor coming off the sea. You know,
what does tritium do to the human body? I mean, what does that do to us?
Well, it's just the same as all internal radiation. It damages the DNA, causes mutations, and as a result of that, you get cancer. Your children die. I mean, just as the invertebrate children die, okay, in the studies by Jar, mm-hmm. Actual human children die as they develop, because as you know, I mean,
wow.
In the womb, when the child starts to develop in the womb, it is an invertebrate almost right at the beginning,
right.
You know? It goes right through all of these developmental stages that evolution has laid down. I did a study in Diablo Canyon. I was paid some money to look at Diablo Canyon, which releases a lot of tritium, and I to the Pacific. And what I did was I looked at the people who lived in the zip codes that were close to the Pacific, and then compared them with the people who lived in the next zip code away, and then compared those to the whole of California. And I published this. It's out there, you know, in a paper published by a peer review journal, quite recently this year, I think it was.
Do you know what the title is? Do you remember?
No. If you type into Google Busby Diablo Canyon infant, you'll find
okay.
it. Okay.
Okay.
And what it showed was that there was a statistically significant effect that people who lived in the whole of California over the period that we were looking, I think it was 1999 through to 2012. Anyway, over that period, infant mortality fell because, you know, over that period, you know, technology has provided better medical attention. Yeah. But in fact, if you look at the proximal coastal zip code area, it went down right when Diablo Canyon started. I think we went back to when it started, 1988 or something like that. It went down immediately, and then it went up. So although the whole of California
wow.
went down like that, the infant mortality rate went up. And we could then plot the infant mortality rate against the tritium releases, because I found the tritium releases, they're documented. And if you look at the paper, you'll see there's a graph of the tritium, accumulated tritium dose against the infant mortality rate, and it's a straight line. So there is evidence that tritium causes these developmental effects in human beings, as well as in mussels and in ragworm, those things that you go fishing with, you know.
Us to accept cancer? Is that like really the deal? They just expect us to just accept death so that we can have this magical energy, as they call it?
No. Well, they don't. I mean, well, they do, but not to the extent that in which it actually happens. That's the point. So they do. So on one level, you're right. They say, well, you know, it's very magical that we've got all this energy and it will save us from this and that and global warming and all this stuff. And as a result of that, we unfortunately have to allow one person in 10,000 to die of cancer. But the problem is they're wrong. It's not one person in 10,000. It's like much more than that, you know.
Right.
And so that's and also they don't mention infant mortality at all. So there are a number of issues that
genetic mutations, or the kind of problems. A lot of children don't die that are born near these places, but they have problems. Like my sister lives near 3 nuclear power plants. She has 3 autistic grandchildren.
Right, yes.
That's pretty serious. That's an impact on their lives,
I know. Well, anyway, the point is it's all getting worse, okay? This is, you know, the baseline here is that I think, or at least my position is, as a result of 25 years of work, that it's quite clear that we are poisoning the entire planet, and this has been happening since about 1945. And the result of that is that we've got increases in infertility, we've got increases in genetic damage that's resulting in congenital malformations in children, in lots more abortions because they pick up these congenital diseases earlier on by ultrasound and by amniocentesis and so on. So the way it's going, I can see that it's going to be increasingly difficult to have children unless you should flush out all the eggs in one go, you know, using this IVF treatments that they have now. And then goodness knows what you're going to get then. You know, these test tube babies, I mean, all right, so they say, oh, well, you know, Gemma was conceived in a test tube and how clever this is and so on. But we don't know what's going to happen to Gemma. We don't know what's going to happen to her. Is she going to die at 40? Is she going to, you know, is her heart going to give out at 37? What's going to happen to her? I mean, people who were born in 1915, 1920, they're still alive. You know, there's a bloke called Nicholas Parsons on the radio here. He's 93 and he's still kicking ass, you know. But we don't know what's going to happen to all these Dolly the Sheep people, you know, that are being produced now.
They kind of expect us just to embrace that this is the new way, that that's going to be the new humanity. And, you know, to me, I just find it so – I'm kind of like confounded about these two things. First, that the people in charge of this are just willing to accept mass death and mutations. And second, that the people who are experiencing the mass death and mutations are just like clicking their heels saying Sieg Heil and going along with it and refusing to stand up. Like, Fukushima's going to be happening on 3/6/2017, 6 years ongoing, nonstop. The secrecy, the lies, the misinformation, all of it that's gone on about it. I'm attempting to organize like a protest or some type of a commemoration. I actually had this idea that maybe we could put an art show together at the university. I don't know if it's too late, but I'm going to see if that doesn't work. I'm still going to do some type of a protest, but for real, try to get 100 people there. It's impossible. You can't get people to stand up and say, we're done being poisoned.
I agree. I talked to long ago, when I first started this in 92, I talked to this guy who was then the director of Greenpeace. And he said, look, Chris, you know, bodies are going to have to float down rivers before anyone does anything. But the truth is that bodies are floating down rivers. It's just nobody looks.
Yeah. They're just like, well, let's look at the other river where there's no bodies floating.
You know, the trouble is this, that you know, we can't blame these people because they've got to survive. I mean, what they do is they have to work. They come home shattered. And they have to worry about whether the car can be fixed. And all of this stuff, you know. I'm different because I've always been outside the system. I've more or less lived in a cardboard box, you know, because I refuse to. So it's just all the old hippies that are doing this stuff.
The old hippies, actually. Yeah. That's what I've noticed. It's all the old people. I'm 61. There's like nothing but old people involved. I mean, we had a symposium here in town, and it was the same old 30 hippies that go to every single... Yeah. The young people look at you as if you're just get over it. Like, there's nothing you can do. Just enjoy your life. Just move on.
I don't think they're even interested in it. I mean, what they're interested in is Facebook and sort of appearing, presenting themselves, you know, in some way on the internet and spending their whole time fiddling with their iPhones. I know that's...
I think they're interested, but I think they're just so angry, Chris, and they feel so disempowered that they really don't know what to do. They throw up their hands and go, okay, you know, like, we can't do anything. And I mean, they're just so outraged that we've been manipulated and lied. The ones that do know about it are very angry people, actually, to be honest.
Well, it's a political issue. It's a political issue. Anyway, I have a plan. All right? I do have a plan.
Okay, great.
Mean, you know, I have a number of plans. But anyway, one plan to address this issue that you're talking about is what we need is an ideology. You know, the problem is that that there is no ideology now. We live in a sort of like a market chaos, which is in that everybody has to accept that you know everything is inevitable because it's driven by the market. See, and that's if there is an ideology, that's the one that's been sold. Now, there used to be the ideology of the Soviet Union, which is kind of vaguely associated with Marxism, and that in itself was an ideology, but it's out of date. It had to do with a system that no longer exists, where you had workers and you had capitalists and all this kind of stuff, you know. So somebody needs to produce something like Adam Smith, something like Rousseau, something like, you know, what's going on and what can we do about it, right? Somebody's got to do that, and nobody has. Nobody has. So there's nothing that anybody can tie themselves to anymore to say, this is how we want to live our lives, right? So, I mean, I didn't want to have to do this because it's a pain in the arse, I have to say. But since nobody else is going to do it, I will.
That's kind of how I feel about
it,
yeah.
So I'm going to go off on my boat at some point when I've got a minute, when I finish this fracking study, which I'm doing now. That's quite an interesting thing, too. And I'm going to write the new ideology, right? Then I'm going to present it off on the stage with a Fender electric guitar and sing it to the people. You know?
Oh, good. Well, we'll talk to you about that when you come out with your ideology. That would be really great.
Yeah.
So in the fracking, this is another thing about the fracking industry. Do they use nuclear waste or nuclear pollution in the fracking industry?
No, they don't. But I don't think so. I mean, it would be a way of getting rid of the nuclear waste. But I have got no evidence that they do that. But what I think they do is they do uranium shaped charge warheads, because those things, you know how it works. They drill down and they drill sideways. Okay. Then what they've got to do is they make an explosion which cracks up all of the shale, you know, and clears all the space so that the gas will come out. See. Now, the point is that if you're going to do that, it's much more efficient to do it with a very efficient warhead. And the most efficient warhead they've got is a uranium-shaped charge warhead. So I think probably after all, what the hell, you know, they can get rid of this waste, which is uranium. They can make a shaped charge of it, and they can make sort of like 300% more fracked volume per unit mass of explosive using that. So I think they probably, that is what is happening, and they do blast these big frack holes, you know.
They do use nuclear components in the fracking.
Radioactive components.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was an intuitive thing when I was thinking about it. Like, they have to, that would make perfect sense for them to use this because that's their idea of solving the waste problem.
Of course. Of course, that's right. But I mean, the main thing about fracking is the amount of uranium that they would use if they were using it is like quite small compared to the amount of uranium that's released anyway. Because, you know, like Tom Waits sings, there's a lot going on underground. And if you go underground, there's an awful lot of radioactivity down there, okay?
Yeah, yeah.
And if you take the Marcellus Shale in Pennsylvania, it's absolutely, you know, chock-a-block with uranium and thorium and radium and all that, and polonium and all that stuff, you know. So what they do, as you know, when you do fracking, is you pump a load of water down there and you explode it all. So the pressure then, you know, cracks everything up, and you create a lot of space. And the water contains all these fracking injection solids, bits of sand and whatnot, to allow the gas to come out. And then you pump out all this stuff, which is called produced water. And because it's been down there in contact with all these radionuclides like uranium and radium and whatnot, it's like totally full of uranium and radium and all the rest of it, you see. And these people don't know what to do with it. So what they do is they quietly dispose of it by just pumping it away over the ground, or they put it somewhere, and, you know, and it sort of, if you go to Pennsylvania, if you look at the websites of the Pennsylvania state on violations, enormous amount of violations in the fracking territories, because these people just kind of discharge it onto the ground, and then it gets into the watercourses, and it affects the water supply that people drink. So then, of course, all the babies die. See, just like I was saying to you about the tritium. So there's lots of evidence already published that the babies are dying.
I think it's so unconscionable our governments don't stop that. I mean, I'm just like blown away that nobody within the power of governments will just say this is not tolerable.
Well, you see, the problem is that the capitalist system, if we can call it that, just as a shorthand, the system that we have at the moment that makes money, what it does is it needs to have energy in order to do that, right? So in other words, what happens is that it manufactures loads and loads of things that then it, you know, makes people buy with advertising. And a lot of these things, or most of these things, are totally unnecessary. You know, people just need love and comfort and all that. But instead, no, they get all of these things that you see in the shops when you go along. And there's all these shops and they sell things. Well, to make the shops and sell the things, you need to use huge amounts of energy. So they need to have the energy, which means they have to have the gas. Well, now they can no longer get the gas and the oil from the Middle East. It's very difficult to do that because of all the Arabs and all the problems and all the rest of it, you know. So what they do in America now is they've, and in fact all over the world, is that they've discovered that if they go underground, they can rip even more stuff out of Mother Earth, you know, by blowing.
It's really just about money then. It's all about money, period. Money, money, money. That's it. That's the thing.
That's why it comes back to ideology, you see, because the ideology has to be shifted from we need to have loads of money and be rich to we need to be happy and love one another.
We need another love revolution. I've always had this theory that the CIA killed the love revolution because we were getting liberated, so they got in and killed it, you know.
Of course they did. They killed it with drugs, didn't they?
Yeah. You know. Well, with everything, with money and with drugs. They killed it with drugs and money. I mean, the people that wouldn't take drugs, they took the other drug, which was money, right? So that's kind of the thing. But we do need a love revolution. That's actually one of the things I say in my intro is love is greater than fear, you know, and happiness is resistance. And I'm beginning to say I'm happy to resist. Well, look, we've got 2 minutes left or a minute and a half left. I want to thank you for joining us on the radio show. To my listeners, just to remind you, we've been listening with Dr. Chris Busby. He's an expert witness and expert scientist in the, I guess, the field of nuclear pollution. Is that correct, Chris?
Yes, well, that's right. Nuclear pollution and health. That's right.
That's right. Well, look, I really appreciate this interview. I hope that sometime in the next few months you'll come back and join us again, because I obviously, as you can tell, I have lots to think about on that. I have lots to say on this one. And I want to keep having it back in people's faces so that we can't go to sleep and turn it off. I want us to remind people that this is, I think it's the most important issue of our time.
This is, by the way, before I go, this is video, right? This is going out as a video, not as a
radio. No, this will go out as an audio.
Oh, right.
This is not
okay.
A video. It'll go out as an audio on UCY.TV. So okay. It'll come out. I'll send you the podcast. We actually podcast on our radio station.
Otherwise, I'd have had to put on my makeup, wouldn't I?
That's right. Me too. Exactly right. I had to put on better glasses.
Yeah, that's right. Okay.
Well, it's been a pleasure to meet you. Thank you for joining us, and we'll talk with you soon. Everybody, please put your courage feet on, take some action, and remember, love is greater than fear. We'll talk with you soon.
Truth on the Tracks. You can catch every Monday night and Friday night at 9 p.m. Eastern.